to be in 1 Samuel 16 this morning. As we kind of do a quick overview of the time of the kings, I was going to try to do a king a week, but then I realized with David, you kind of have to slow way down a little bit. So David will probably take 2 to 3 weeks, and then after that, it's going to go a whole lot faster. So 1 Samuel chapter 16, that's where we'll be this morning. And what we're going to be looking at today is basically how David becomes king. There's a lot of little snippets of information that you can skip over. Sometimes when we're reading this, we have a tendency to read through the Bible in a year, which is a great thing. But when you're only reading 2, 3, maybe 4 chapters at a time, trying to keep track of who's who, family relationships, names of cities and places and all those type of things, you can miss a lot of the information. And our goal is that what we see here, we kind of go from black and white to color and fill in a lot of the missing information to give you a better understanding of what's going on. So 1 Samuel 16, and we'll begin in verse 1. The Lord said to Samuel, "How long will you mourn for Saul, seeing I've rejected him from reigning over Israel? Fill your horn with oil, and I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided me a king among his sons." We looked last week about Saul being king, we looked at him being rejected, and we looked at his death. This is kind of backing up a little bit. This is right after Saul has disobeyed God, and this is where he disobeyed God in the matter of the Amalekites. He has been rejected, and God now wants Samuel to go and anoint a new king. Now, he mentions Jesse here. Many times we don't draw the connection between the book of Ruth and David. Okay, and Ruth being a Moabite, we're going to see that the Moabites have some relationship with David. That's because his great-grandmother was a full-blooded Moabite. That's Ruth. So the story of Ruth, in many respects, though it's a neat story, is really just paving the way for David, giving the background of how David came to be. Boaz is his great-grandfather. So this is all that background information. Keep that in mind as you read about David. So Jesse has, I believe it's 10 children, 7 sons, 3 daughters. He may have 8 sons, I can't remember exactly, but he has a lot of kids. So Samuel, verse 6, goes to anoint one of his sons as king. It came to pass when they were come that he looked on Eliab and said, "Surely the Lord's anointed is before him." But the Lord said to Samuel, "Look not on his countenance or on the height of his stature, because I have refused him. For the Lord sees not as man sees, for man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart." Remember, whenever you're reading the Old Testament, Jesus talked about how the Old Testament tells of him. And as we read it, we want to learn about the gospel. What was one of the defining characteristics of Saul? He was taller than everyone else. Okay, his outward appearance. When we come to the gospel, the gospel is not about the outward appearance. It is not about outward deeds. It is about a new heart. It is about a regenerative work of the Holy Spirit within. So when we look at people, it's not like the Pharisees. Remember the Pharisees, Jesus called them whitewashed tombs. On the outside, they looked great. Inside, they were messed up. Okay? Saul looks great. Okay, but we're not going by outward appearance. So here, Eliab looks great. And he says, no, remember, it's not the outward appearance that matters. Saul looked great, but his heart was arrogant. His heart was rebellious. So we're not looking to repeat the same mistakes. We want to look on the inside. We want to see what God sees when he looks at someone. So Jesse called Abinadab, and he made him pass before Samuel. And he said, "Neither has the Lord chosen this one." Then Jesse made Shammah to pass by, and he said, "Neither has the Lord chosen this." Again, Jesse made 7 of his sons to pass before Samuel. And Samuel said to Jesse, "The Lord has not chosen you." Samuel said to Jesse, "Are here all your children?" And he said, "There remains yet the youngest. Behold, he keeps the sheep." Samuel said to Jesse, "Send and fetch him, for we will not sit down till he comes here." He was sent and brought him in, and he was ruddy, and with all of a beautiful countenance and goodly to look to. And the Lord said, "Arise, anoint him, for this is he." Samuel took the horn of oil, anointed him in the midst of his brethren, and the Spirit of the Lord came upon David from that day forward. So Samuel rose up and went to Ramah. Several things to note here. David is the youngest. What you're going to find is that David has a lot of problems with Joab, specifically.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And Joab is always referred to as the son of Zariah, son of Zariah, son of Zariah. And we just kind of skip over that. Zariah is David's older sister. So Joab is his nephew. But when you have 11 kids, because it's 7 sons and then David being the 8th, 11 kids, it's very possible that Zariah was one of the older ones, and it's very possible that Joab may have been his age or even older. Okay, when you think of big families, there's some families in our church that can understand this. When you have 11 kids, the spacing between them can be 20 years. When you're getting married at 14 years old and you have your first kid at 15, right, you could have children for 30 years. So when you have that many children, it's very possible that Joab was raised more like an older brother, at the very least as a playmate with David. So just keep that in mind, because this type of stuff is going to keep coming back up throughout the rest of the book. So David is chosen because of his heart, because of what the Lord sees in him. But also notice, from David's perspective, is David really wanted or even thought of as by his own father as being king material? No. Even his own father doesn't think he's king material. Right? So that you're going to have some of this play in when David goes and kills Goliath. His brothers say, "What are you doing here? Go home." Because they don't even see anything in him. But the Lord sees what we do not see. And this is also a very good lesson for us, because sometimes we have a tendency to look in the mirror and say, "I am of no use to the kingdom of God because of what I see. Because of what I've done, because of my past, because of my family, because of those things." No, David becomes the greatest king in Israel, and his own father didn't think he was king material. Let's keep reading and go on to, let's go in verse 14. This gives us a lot of information too. "But the spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, an evil spirit from the Lord troubled him. Saul's servants said to him, 'Behold, now an evil spirit from God troubles you. Let our Lord now command your servants, which are before you, to seek out a man who is a cunning player on a harp. It will come to pass, when the evil spirit from God is upon you, he will play with his hand, and you will be well.' Saul said to his servants, 'Provide me now a man that can play well, and bring him to me.' Then answered one of the servants and said, 'Behold, I have seen the son of Jesse, the Bethlehemite, that is cunning and plain, and a mighty valiant man, a man of war, and prudent in matters, and a comely person, and the Lord is with him. Wherefore Saul sent messengers to Jesse and said, Send me David your son, which is with the sheep. Jesse took a donkey laden with bread and a bottle of wine and kid, and sent them by David his son to Saul. David came to Saul and stood before him, and he loved him greatly, and he became his armor-bearer. Saul sent to Jesse, saying, Let David, I pray you, stand before me, for he has found favor in my sight. It came to pass, when the evil spirit from God was upon Saul, that David took a harp, played with his hand, so Saul was refreshed and was well, and the evil spirit departed from him." We don't have a chronology here, but it would appear that verses 14 through verse 23 comes after chapter 17 in chronology. You'll have this a lot of times in the Bible when they're telling stories. We, as a culture, are very chronological. But when you read Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, they are not chronological. They are trying to tell a story to make a point. Here, verses 14 through verse 23, you're going to find in chapter 17, Saul doesn't know who David is, has no idea who he is. Here, this little shepherd boy is a valiant man and a great warrior. How on earth would they know that? Okay? That's because it probably comes afterwards, and they're trying to show a connection here. Because what we're going to look at this morning is how God takes David from caring for the sheep, the youngest kid, and turns him around and puts him in place to be king. Okay, what we're going to see is there's a lot of little things, a lot of little pieces that fall in place that make David such a successful king. Here, he becomes Saul's armor bearer. When we think of an armor bearer, we think of, in our understanding, that's somebody who just carries around somebody else's luggage. That's not what an armor bearer was. An armor bearer would go behind the person they fought for, and in warfare of those days, I mean, you're not shooting people in the head with a rifle, you're not throwing hand grenades, you are stabbing people, you are hacking them with swords and axes and those type of things. So an armor bearer would go behind and basically kill all the people that the person wounded. If there was archery going on, they would stand in front with a shield while the guy behind them was protected by the shield. And then when it got to hand-to-hand combat, he would fall behind. And as King Saul went and cut down everybody, I mean, he may cut someone's hand off, but they're not dead yet. So they could use their other hand. He may cut their leg off and they're going to fall down. But in this type of hand-to-hand combat, getting stabbed in the stomach, they're going to live a couple more hours, and they have a chance to come back and keep fighting. So David's job was to come behind Saul and basically kill everyone that Saul wounded. And this would be something that would be a very privileged position. It would also be where you learn a lot about the king. You're the king's right-hand man. You are beside him all the time.
David's also in the palace because he's also playing the harp to help calm Saul down when this evil spirit comes upon him. So he's learning all the ways of the kingdom. He's learning about all of these things. God takes him from the sheep fields and he puts him literally in the throne room and literally has him following in the footsteps of the king as the king's right-hand man. You can see how he's painting everything together for David to be the next king. Chapter 17 is the story of David and Goliath. We won't spend much time on it. But I want you to notice a couple things here. Chapter 17, verse 22. David left his carriage in the hand of the keeper of the carriage, ran to the army, and came and saluted his brothers. As he talked with him, behold, there came out up the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, out of the armies of the Philistines, and spoke according to the same words, and David heard them. All the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were sore afraid. The men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man that has come up? Surely to defy Israel he's come up. And it'll be that the man who kills him, the king will enrich him with great riches." Notice this. "Will give him his daughter." Now you become the king's son-in-law. Now think about this. If all the king's sons die, who is next in line to the throne? The king's son-in-law. So if you kill Goliath, you become the king's son-in-law. And if there happens to be a war, which there will be, where the king dies, and Saul does, and all of his sons die, guess who is next in line to the throne? David will be. Okay? So this is how God is again putting all the pieces together. Okay? And will make his father's house free in Israel. The word free there means taxes. They won't have to pay taxes. That's the idea of free there. David spoke to the men that stood by him, saying, "What shall be done to the man that kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" The people answered him after this manner, saying, "So will it be done to him that kills him." And Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men. Eliab's anger was kindled against David, and he said, "Why did you come down here? Where have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your pride and the naughtiness of your heart, for you come down that you might see the battle." Now notice again, David here is being rejected by his oldest brother. The oldest brother, by the way, who's too much of a coward to go fight Goliath. "I know you." No, you really don't. You don't even know yourself. You're a coward who won't go down and fight. Okay? Verse 29. David said, "What have I now done? Is there not a cause?" He turned from him toward another and spoke after the same manner, and the people answered him again after the former manner. So, verse 31, when the words were rehearsed, which David spoke, they rehearsed them before Saul, and he sent for him. So everybody says, hey, there's somebody that says he'll go fight. Saul won't fight. Abner won't fight. No one else will fight. Well, here's the little boy. He's willing to fight. So this is where we kind of get the idea that what we looked at in chapter 16 comes after this, because Saul has no idea who David is. David talks about how he's never used a sword, how he's never worn armor. Well, if he was the king's armor bearer, he would be using a sword on a regular basis in war. So that's where we get the idea that it's probably after this. Verse 43. Goliath the Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you come to meet with me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. The Philistines said to David, "Come to me, and I will give your flesh to the fowls of the air and to the beasts of the field." Then said David to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day will the Lord deliver you into my hand. I will smite you, take your head from you, and I will give the carcass of the host of the Philistines this day to the fowls of the air, the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel." And all this assembly, what assembly is he speaking of here? Well, the Philistines, but also all of the Israelites. All the Israelites that are scared. Okay? This assembly will know that the Lord saves not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. Pause for just a second. When Saul has the Philistines invade, what is Saul worried about? He's worried about all of the people leaving him. He's worried that as every day passes, his army gets smaller and smaller. And the only way you can win the war is if you have a big army, right? And so he goes and offers a sacrifice. Why? To show how great God is? No. To try to rally the troops and get God to give him more troops. Notice the difference in the heart attitude between David and Saul. David is willing to go into battle alone to show how great God is. Saul is willing to reject God's law and inject himself into the priesthood so he has a bigger army. Completely polar opposites when it comes to the heart. And also, Saul being super tall and David being a little guy, probably this time 12, 13 years of age, there's also a big opposite on the outside as well. Verse 48, it came to pass when the Philistine arose and came and drew near to David, that David hasted, ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. David put his hand in his bag, took from there a stone and slung it, and smote the Philistine in his forehead. The stone sunk into his forehead, and he fell upon his face to the earth. Remember when we talked about the geography of Israel and how it was very suited for slings and for bows and arrows? A sling was a deadly, deadly, deadly weapon. It is, in some respects, it's almost the precursor to a gun, because you are throwing a rock with enough speed to literally sink into someone's head. Okay, to literally shatter someone's forehead and sink into their brain. That is how much force you can get from a sling. Okay, very, very, very powerful. And as we looked back in Judges about the left-handed men that could throw a stone at a hair's breadth and not miss, that is extremely deadly when you're talking this type of terrain. If you have a chariot, maybe you can get in, but it's very hilly, very rocky. And so you're on foot, and you have people throwing a stone that can literally go straight through your forehead, and they don't miss. Very, very good defense for the nation of Israel. Okay, let's keep reading. David prevailed over the Philistine, verse 50, with a sling and a stone, smote the Philistine, and slew him. But there was no sword in the hand of David. Therefore David ran, stood upon the Philistine, took his sword, drew it out of the sheath thereof, and slew him, cut off his head with it. And when the Philistines saw the champion was dead, they fled. The men of Israel and of Judah arose, shouted, pursued the Philistines, until you come to the valley, to the gates of Ekron. And the wounded of the Philistines fell down by the way to Shearim, even unto Gath and to Ekron. And the children of Israel returned from chasing after the Philistines, and they spoiled their tents. David took the head of the Philistine, brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his armor in his tent. And when Saul saw David go forth against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the captain of the host, "Abner, whose son is this youth?" And Abner said, "As your soul lives, O king, I cannot tell." The king said, "Inquire whose son the stripling is." And as David returned from the slaughter of the Philistines, Abner took him, brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" And David answered, "I am the son of your servant, Jesse the Bethlehemite." Again, this is where you kind of get the idea that afterwards he becomes Saul's armor bearer. I mean, after all, who would you want fighting beside you? This guy's scared of nothing. Pretty good, and that obviously has no problem finishing off the enemy when they're knocked down. No problem whatsoever, no hesitation. Okay? Chapter 18. Now we're going to see Saul turn on David. Verse 6. It came to pass as they came, they're coming back from the victory. When David was returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, the women came out of all the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tabrets, with joy, and with instruments of music. This would be very common. Imagine all the men in your city going out to war and being left as a woman, as a teenage girl. Is daddy coming home? Is my brother coming home? You look over the hill. It could be the army has just slaughtered everyone and they're coming to come and pillage your town and kill all of you. So when you saw the army return, all the women would go out and they would sing and they would dance and they'd celebrate because everybody came back safe. So the women answered one another as they played, and they said, "Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s. By the way, who was the hero of the battle? God was. Who did God use? David. Why? Because David's humble, and David relies on the Lord, and David wants God to get all the glory. Why isn't Saul going out there? Because Saul is relying on his strength. He's relying on his numbers. He's relying on his flesh. You can see between David and Saul, there is a comparison and contrast between the flesh and the spirit that is really hashed out in the New Testament. You can see a living illustration of flesh, Saul, and spirit, David. Okay? Saul is angry, and the saying displeased him. And he said, "They've ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they've ascribed but thousands. What more can he have but the kingdom?" He says, everybody loves David, everybody hates me, he's going to be king after me. So he eyed David from that day forward. So the solution here is, let's kill David. The solution here is not, let's repent and let's turn to the Lord. The solution here is not,
hey, you know, let's celebrate this guy killing the giant, and let's celebrate what God has done. So his idea here is, I'm just going to kill him. So, verse 10, it came to pass on the next day that an evil spirit from God came upon Saul, and he prophesied in the midst of his house. And David played with his hand. David's there. He's playing the harp, as at other times. And there is a spear in Saul's hand. Saul cast the javelin and said, I will smite David into the wall with it. And David avoided him out of his presence twice. This happens twice. What does it tell you about David? Okay, can you imagine being in someone's house and they throw a spear at you? And they call you up and they say, just kidding, will you come back? Okay. If you come back and you sit down and you start playing the harp again, he's got the spear in his hand again. Chunks the spear at you again. Okay. Well, you would think by this point in time, David would say, no. But we see here that David is a very gracious person because of God's grace in his life. Saul is now scared of David, verse 12, because God is with David and has departed from Saul. Verse 13, therefore Saul removed him from him and made him his captain over 1,000, and he went out and came in from before the people. Okay, so he gets an idea. If I can't kill David myself, well, if David's my armor bearer, where's David always going to be? Where King Saul is. I know what I'll do. I'll make him a captain over 1,000 people, and I'll send him out to battle, so he's got to lead the men in the battle, not stay by me. Right? But David doesn't die in battle. David behaved himself wisely in all his ways, and the Lord was with him. Verse 15. Wherefore, when Saul saw that he behaved himself very wisely, he was afraid of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David because he went out and came in before them. The phrase going out and coming in before them is going to be used over and over and over again. The general idea here is that he was accessible and he was relatable. Sometimes we talk about politicians being out of touch. Okay, well, they live in mansions and they, you know, live in gated communities and you can't talk to them, all the type of things. So politicians today, they try to show that they're relatable and they actually don't wear a suit sometimes and they kiss babies and sometimes they get really awkward photos because you can tell they're not used to being around normal people. David lives among the people. Okay, he's just one of the guys. When they go out to war, he leads them. Okay, when they go and sleep, he sleeps in the same ditch they sleep in. Okay, he doesn't have his special tent. He doesn't stay in the palace. Saul is sending them out. By the way, David is going to change about the time of Bathsheba. Okay, you're going to see part of David's fall is he doesn't go out with the men anymore. And one of the reasons Absalom gains the support of the people is because Absalom is among the people. Okay, David is at this point in time and now the people. So you begin to see how God is putting everything in place for David to be king. Armor bearer. Now he's general. Now he's killed Goliath. He's now a hero. But he's not just a hero. Everybody can come up and talk to him. He's just a regular guy. He spends time with them. He doesn't show that he's better than them or thinks more of them. You know, I mean, you would think that somebody who was a general who killed Goliath, which, by the way, we still talk about, 3,000 years later, you would think that that would go to his head. But he's just a regular guy. And because of this, Saul is getting more and more scared because you have a guy who's popular, who's a general, who's a leader, all of those things. So Saul comes up with a great idea. Verse 20. Michal, Saul's daughter, loves David. And they told Saul, and the thing pleased him. I mean, because you want your daughter to marry a godly man who's successful? No. That's not why it pleased him. Saul said, I'll give him to her that she may be a snare to him, that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. No, in his mind, it's not about getting his daughter married to a godly man. It's using his daughter to get David killed. Now, notice how warped you become when you walk away from the Lord. When you fall into sin, your thinking becomes very, very twisted. People stand up and say, oh, I would never. You begin to stray from the Lord, and you will do all the stuff you said you would never do. Okay? It's a slippery slope, and your mind and your thinking become warped and perverted and twisted. I mean, can you imagine using your daughter as bait to kill your enemy? I mean, that's how twisted he is. So, wherefore Saul said in verse 21, said to David, you will this day be my son-in-law, and one of the two. You're going to marry one of my daughters. Saul commanded his servant, saying, by the way, Saul broke his word. because he was supposed to marry the king's daughter back when he killed Goliath. Now, he breaks his word, but he can do that because he's a king, you know, and he doesn't have to do what God says. All right, so verse 22. Saul commanded his servants, saying, "Commune with David secretly and say, 'Behold, the king has delight in you, and all his servants love you. Now, therefore, be the king's son-in-law.'" Now, if a man threw a spear at you twice and tried to get you killed, how eager would you be to marry his daughter? Good, thanks. Right? And by the way, David's the national hero. Do you think David has to worry about women? No. So Saul has all of his servants kind of convince David, "Oh, King Saul really likes you. He just wanted to see how quick your reflexes work when he threw the spear at you. He really does secretly like you. And, oh man, it would be so great if you could marry the king's daughter," yada, 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 yada. Okay? So, verse 23, "Saul's servant spoke these words in the ears of David. And David says, 'Does it seem to you a light thing to be the king's son-in-law, seeing that I am a poor man and lightly esteemed?'" He goes, whoa. It doesn't matter how much Saul likes me. I am a poor guy. I'm just a little nobody. Now, notice the attitude of Saul and his pride and David and his humility. David is humble. Saul is proud. But also, at this time, when you got married, people look at the dowry and all that type of stuff, and they say, "Oh, women were bought and sold like property." It's exactly the exact opposite. Women were valuable. Very valuable. Okay? They pulled their weight. They weren't just hood ornaments. Okay? They wasn't just a trophy wife. If you had a daughter, the amount of work you could get done, and by subsequent, the amount of wealth you could produce, was greatly multiplied. Okay? In our society, children are seen as a drain. In that society, children made a massive effect on your wealth. Okay? When you have to go out and plow a field by hand, if one man can do 10 acres a year, guess what two men can do? 20 acres, three men, and so forth. And so when you had sons, as they grew older, they could do more labor. And the girls, all they did was stay inside and have babies. No. Go read about the American women. Thoreau that came and did the survey of America? And he said that basically America was built on the back of women because of how solid the American pioneer woman was. All the work and labor that she did, he said, you know, there's a difference between the American women and the European women, because the American women were such hard workers, they multiplied the family's labors. Now, you have three or four daughters, all of a sudden, you can do so much more work. Right? So much more work, so much more profit, and that's how you could build wealth. Because you could farm more, you could produce more. When you went beyond subsistence farming, you could then sell it, and then you could make money. Okay? And while the men are out working, the ladies can be selling it, they can be preparing, they can be cooking. It made just all the wealth of the family so much greater. So if you wanted to go and take someone's daughter, okay, he is going to lose a massive amount of his means of producing wealth. Okay, this was not someone who just sat around on her phone all day and consumed resources. This is someone who produced wealth for the family. Okay? You can laugh because it does hurt some people. Okay? It's the truth. Okay? The women of that day worked hard. And now when you begin to take about, I'm just going to take your daughter, and now she's going to work for me, and she's going to double my labors and produce wealth for me. Okay? She produces for our family 60 grand a year. And you're going to come take her from me? No, you better make it equal. And so in that respect, it was not buying and selling women like property. No, the women actually had value to their family. They were valued by their parents. They were valued by their husband. They were valued by the society. So David doesn't have any money. Okay, how valuable does a princess have to be? Okay, and even if he could afford the dowry, what type of house are you going to build for her? How on earth are you going to afford her clothes? I mean, you talk about high maintenance. Marry the king's daughter. I mean, that is high maintenance right there. Okay, so
Verse 24, the servants of Saul told him, saying, on this manner spoke David. Saul said, thus will you say to David, the king desires not any dowry, but 100 foreskins of the Philistines to be avenged of the king's enemies. But Saul thought to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines. Hey, go kill 100 Philistines. That's all he wants, 100 dead Philistines. Okay, when the servants told David these words, it pleased David well to be the king's son-in-law, and the days were not expired. All right, he got a little bit of time left. Go kill 100 Philistines, and you know what? Can you imagine being a Philistine and just watching this madman do this? Like, I mean, just those of you who are older know what I'm talking about. Can you just imagine going, whoa, what's going on here? And then he gets up and he looks and goes, and they come chasing you? I don't know. It just makes me laugh every time I think about it. When David arose and went, and he and his men, and he slew the Philistines 200 men, and brought them to the foreskins, brought their foreskins and gave them the full tally of the king. Who on earth would want to count that he might be the king's son-in-law? And Saul gave him Michal, his daughter, to wife. So he goes above and beyond. He kills 200 men. Okay? Saul's plan doesn't work. Now, guess who is the king's son-in-law and in line to the throne? David is. If you ever wondered, because after this, Saul is going to send Michal away to somebody else, and there's a big falling out, Michal marries somebody else, and all those other things. Have you ever wondered one of the first things David does, and I think we're going to look at it today, one of the first things David does when he becomes king is that I want my wife back.
Yeah.
Why? Because she is his legitimate claim to the throne. And if he doesn't have Michal, he is not the king's son-in-law and is a usurper. By the way, when you are king, you want to be a legitimate king, not someone who commits regicide or usurps the king's throne. Why? Because if you usurp the king's throne, what are you teaching everyone after you? Okay? You can do the same thing. Okay? All right, let's see here. So, verse 28. Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David, and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him. And Saul was yet the more afraid of David, and Saul became David's enemy continually. Then the princes of the Philistines went forth, and it came to pass that they went forth, that David behaved himself more wisely than all the servants of Saul, so that his name was set by. Saul's plan backfires, and David becomes more popular, is now in line to the throne, and more people love him, and he's more and more successful. So this is not the guy that killed Goliath. This is the guy that, in order to marry the king's daughter, went out and killed 200 Philistines by himself. Okay? So everything Saul's doing here backfires. Which, by the way, when you operate in the flesh, it does backfire. When you try to do things in your own strength, you're only going to make things worse. This is just when you sow to the flesh, you reap corruption. When you try to do things your own way, you are going to mess everything up. This is why we have to repent, walk in the Spirit, trust the Lord, and follow His ways. All right, chapter 22. Okay, let's skip ahead a little bit. We want to see how David becomes king. Chapter 22, Saul has been chasing David, trying to kill him, all of that. Here is a little tidbit that happens. Chapter 22, verse 1. David therefore departed thence and escaped to the cave of Adullam. Okay, he's running from Saul. He goes to Adullam. And when his brethren and all his father's house heard it, they went down there to him. And everyone that was in distress, everyone that was in debt, everyone that was discontented, gathered themselves to him, and he became a captain over them. And there were with him about 400 men. And verse 3, and David went from there to Mizpah of Moab and said to the king of Moab, let my father and mother, I pray you, come forth and be with you till I know what God will do for me. Verse 4, and he brought them before the king of Moab, and they went and dwelt with him all the time that David was in the hold. Several important things. David takes his family. You don't think that Saul would come after his family, after his parents, after his brothers and sisters? And goes to the king of Moab and says, hey, can my family stay? Why on earth would the king of Moab let David's family stay there? Because they're direct descendants of Moabites. Okay, they are partial Moabites. So he welcomes them. Okay, you can see how all the story of Ruth comes in. But also notice David's popularity. David is not just popular with the soldiers. David is not just popular with all of Saul's servants and all the wealthy, influential people. David is also popular with the down and out, those in debt, the discontented. And so he attracts all of the least of these, all of the rejects of society come to David. So you can see David's popularity is increasing. So when David's going to become king, it's not going to be just the wealthy and powerful and influential people. In our society, and you get to maybe, our society is probably not a good example, maybe Venezuela would be a good example, where you have the ruling class and you have all the poor, starving people. Okay, well, what was it, Zimbabwe, where they had democratic elections, but there was only one man's name allowed on the ballot?
Yeah.
Okay, for like 40 years. And so every year he acted like he was, you know, oh man, I won again. Can you imagine? All the people love me. No, there's only one name on the ballot. Okay, what happens in those societies is the poor people eventually, in French Revolution, get mad at the ruling class and revolt. Does David have the poor people mad at him? No. He's got the poor people on his side, and the wealthy people, and the influential people, and the army. It's all on his side. Now, okay, so he's got the influential people, he's got the army, he's got the poor people. Let's see who else he gets on his side. Chapter 22, verse 18. Through some situations we won't talk about today, Saul gets mad and wants all the priests killed. The king said to Doeg, "Turn and fall upon the priests." Doeg the Edomite turned, and he fell upon the priests and slew on that day 85 persons that did wear a linen ephod. He kills all the priests. And Nob, the city of the priests, smote he with the edge of the sword, both men, women, children, nursing infants, oxen, donkeys, sheep, with the edge of the sword. No, notice Saul. Saul won't kill all the Amalekites, but he'll kill all the priests. Notice how distorted your thinking becomes when you begin to rebel against God. He won't kill Agag, and he won't kill all the animals for the Amalekites, but he'll kill all the priests. He'll kill every single one of them. He'll kill all their infants. He'll kill all their animals. And one of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, fled to David. Abiathar showed David that Saul had slain the Lord's priest. And David said unto Abiathar, "I knew it was that day when Doeg the Edomite was there, that he would surely tell Saul, 'I have occasioned the death of all the persons of your father's house.'" The priest essentially had helped David. Saul got mad because they helped him. He ordered them all to be killed. "Abide with me, fear not, for he that seeks my life seeks your life. Be with me, you will be a safeguard." Now we just kind of read this and we go, oh, David's being nice. No, what David now has is David now has the priesthood.
Yes.
David is now son-in-law, armor-bearer, general, has the wealthy ruling class, has all the people in the palace, has the poor, and now David has the priesthood all on his side. Okay? And he's got God on his side, which is all he needed to begin with. You can see how David is being set up by God perfectly to serve his king. Chapter 26. Chapter 26, verse 6. Notice the wisdom, not just the righteousness. When we look at this and go, oh, David's a nice guy. Notice the wisdom that he implies here, okay? Saul comes, he's chasing David again. David gets an opportunity to kill Saul. Okay, verse 6. "Then answered David and said to Ahimelech the Hittite and Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, brother of Joab, saying, 'Will you go down with me to Saul to the camp?' Abishai said, 'I will go down with you.' So David and Abishai came to the people by night, and behold, Saul lay sleeping within the trench, and his spear stuck in the ground at his bolster, but Abner and the people lay round about him. Then said Abishai to David, 'God has delivered your enemy into your hand this day. Now therefore let me smite him, I pray you, with a spear even to the earth at once, and I will not smite him a second time.'" He says, "You know what? He's sleeping. We're right here. I can kill him. He won't make a noise. And we can get out of here. He'll be dead. You can be king," etc. David said to Abishai, "Do not do this. Don't destroy him not. For who can stretch forth his hands against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless?" One, first priority. This is a sin against God. Okay, this is murder. Okay, this is a sin against God. 10. David said, "Furthermore, as the Lord lives, the Lord will smite him on his day, or his day shall come to die, or he will descend to battle and perish." I will leave this in God's hands. God will take care of this. "The Lord forbid that I would stretch forth my hand against the Lord's anointed. But I pray you, take now the spear that is at his bolster and the cruse of water and let us go." Notice he has an opportunity to kill him, but refuses to because of his fear of God. Do you think that Saul would take the opportunity to kill David if he was given it? Absolutely, because Saul no longer fears God. He's living in rebellion. Okay, 2 Samuel chapter 1, verse 11. 'Then David took hold on his clothes.'" David hears
about Saul dying. Amalekite comes, says, I killed Saul. He was laying there dying. I killed him. David took hold on his clothes, rent them, and likewise all the men that were with him. They mourned and wept and fasted till evening for Saul, for Jonathan and his son, and the people of the Lord, for the house of Israel, because they were fallen by the sword. David said to the young man that told him, whence are you? And he said, I am the son of a stranger, an Amalekite. Hey, remember we talked about the Amalekites had just burnt down David's city, kidnapped all his kids. David said to him, how were you not afraid to stretch forth your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? You should have feared God and not touched the king, even if the king's dying. David called one of the young men and said, go near and fall upon him. He smote him that he died. David said to him, your blood be upon your head, for your mouth has testified against you, saying, I have slain the Lord's anointed. Okay, and then David goes on and weeps for Saul and sings a song of lament for Saul and Jonathan. What is David doing? He is making sure it is very clear, you don't touch the king. Why? Guess who's going to be king? Okay, you don't want to set a precedent that if you don't like the king, you can kill him. Okay, you don't want to set a precedent when the king's asleep, you can kill him. Because guess who has to sleep? David's going to have to sleep when he becomes king. So you want to make sure that you set the precedent right. David also fears God. Okay, so now David's going to be king, right? Not so much. Keep your hand here and turn to 1 Chronicles chapter 2, because this is going to apply a little bit here. 1 Chronicles chapter 2. I want you to see this so you have a little bit of understanding. Again, we read this like we're reading about strangers, but we need to remember that all of these people that are mentioned, they have a background, they have a story that connects to the whole of the story. So 1 Chronicles chapter 2, verse 13. Jesse begot his firstborn, Eliab, Abinadab the second, Shema the third, Nethaneel the fourth, Radai the sixth, Ozan the sixth, David the seventh. So I guess he did have seven sons. I'm getting confused back and forth on that one. Verse 16, whose sisters were Zariah and Abigail, and the sons of Zariah, Abishai, Joab, and Azahel. So there's, I got the number wrong. He had nine kids, supposed to 11. I apologize for that. Okay, but notice here, right? And by the way, notice verse 17, this guy will come up later. Abigail bare Amasa. Okay, he's going to become a general, and Joab's going to kill him as well. Okay, notice the family relationships here. Joab is David's nephew. Azahel is his nephew. Abishai is his nephew. Amasa is his nephew. So when you begin to look at all the people that David chooses to make generals in his army, they're all family members. Okay, which by the way, is where there's going to be some conflict all the way down afterwards, because you have the children of Israel saying, well, we're not really part of the kingdom. Well, because David made all the ruling class people from Judah, his family members. He didn't diversify. That was a mistake that he made. Okay, so back to 2 Samuel chapter 2. We're going to see David become king. I hope we have enough time for this. If we go fast, maybe we can get it all in. 2 Samuel chapter 2, verse 4. The men of Judah came, and there anointed David king over the house of Judah. And they told David, saying that the men of Jabesh-Gilead were they that buried Saul. Saul sent messengers to the men of Jabesh-Gilead and said unto them, blessed are you of the Lord, that you have shown kindness to your Lord, even to Saul, and have buried him. Now the Lord show kindness and truth to you, and I also will requite you this kindness because you've done this thing. Therefore, now let your hand be strengthened, be valiant, for your master Saul is dead, and also the house of Judah have anointed me king over them. Very wise move on David's part. Who was Saul's strongest supporters? The men of Jabesh-Gilead. Why? Well, because one, they're his relatives, and two, because they have both of their eyes because of Saul. So David goes instantly and says, well, I want to show them, the people that are going to be the most skeptical of me becoming king, okay, how much I appreciate them caring for Saul, how much I'm not rejoicing that he's dead. And so he gathers more support. You can see the wisdom here of everything that goes on. For sake of time, I think we'll stop there. We'll pick up again next week about him becoming king. But I want to take some time to kind of apply what we've looked at and just ask a couple questions. One, what are some of the comparison and contrast that you can see between Saul and David? Obviously, pride versus humility. But what are some of the other differences you can see, maybe some lessons we can learn about flesh versus the spirit, about Saul, David, all of that? What are some lessons we can learn from that? Luke?
David used a lot of wisdom in his decision. Saul was pretty rash.
Yes, very much so. Saul... just goes with it, never thinks about how could this backfire. David, I mean, we know it's of the Lord. The wisdom he has from the Lord. But man, you know, you can just read through all this and not even think about it, but look how he is just consolidating power person by person, not in any way, shape, or form in a sinister way, but by just being a friendly, caring guy. Here comes somebody, his whole family's been murdered. I'll protect you. And in doing so, he's got the whole power of the priesthood. Okay? Here comes the people that are running because they're in debt. Well, you know, we're all outlaws together. And he's consolidating support from the poor. Men of Jabesh-Gilead. You can see a tremendous amount of wisdom in what Saul, what David is doing. And Saul, completely rash. Doesn't think about how anything could backfire. What?
Larry? David loved people.
Oh, very much so.
Yeah, because of his love for the Lord, it overflowed in how he responded to others. He responded to everybody in that, up to the point, we fast forward to Bathsheba and the event that happened there, we see what happens. Where his eyes are taken off the Lord, and his eyes are focused on himself, and we see that. So.
Yeah, but you can see, if you love God, you're going to love people. It would be very easy to become bitter if you were David. A man throws a spear at you a couple times, tries to turn your best friend against you, tries to turn your wife against you, tries to get you killed on numerous occasions, and now your buddy says, I'll kill him. Say, no, let's not. And by the way, they're having an argument next to, in the middle of a sleeping army trying to kill them. Okay? You know, I mean, you could at least make the excuse, wow, I didn't want to say no because I might wake him up and get killed. Okay? But you can see David's love for people. By the way, all the people that Saul rejects, uses, and abuses for his own power are all the people that David loves. When we get later on, when we see the civil war that comes to place between Absalom and David, you can see that David loses a lot of this. He becomes very isolated and does not spend time with the people. And by the way, you can look at Jesus. Jesus spent all his time with the down and out. Okay, Jesus was someone who loved people and sought their good. And people could come to him the same way people came to David. Any other thoughts on this? Marie?
Think about Saul. I think it pointed out to me that those, when you go around to seek revenge against something, you just keep getting deeper and deeper in a hole because now what you're trying to do to seek revenge eventually turns around and causes more problems.
Yeah. Well, in some respects, when you read some of the stories, you'll find that David is running from Saul and is just hiding out in the wilderness, and Saul leaves the defense of Israel against the Philistines to go and try to kill David. And many times, the Philistines invading Israel is what saves David's skin. But guess who kills Saul? The Philistines. If he had devoted all his attention to doing his job and not revenge and fighting the Philistines, there's a very good chance. I mean, obviously, we know that God is sovereign and God planned it and it went the way God wanted it to. But from a human perspective, he could have defeated the Philistine archer who shot him. You know? He could have defeated them in battle if he'd actually been doing his job, not seeking revenge. It's such a good lesson on forgiveness, not seeking vengeance, because when you do, it will take you farther than you ever thought. It will twist your sense of judgment. It will warp you. Last thought before we dismiss is I really want us to see Jesus in all of this. And one of the main flaws people have in the Old Testament is we read it for character development. Be like David. Be like David. Don't be like Saul. Be like David. No. You need to die and rise again. And the succession of Saul to David is one of the most beautiful pictures of the gospel, because we are all Saul. And we have to become like David. And the only way we can do that is if we die and rise again. And that's the whole picture of the gospel, that we are arrogant, twisted, vengeful, seeking people. But by God's grace, we can be made new creatures in Christ. And the flesh can be defeated by the Spirit. It's not brought about by our violence. It's not brought about by our power. But God raises David up to give him the throne. And in a manner that you look at it and go, there's no way the youngest boy, whose dad doesn't even think he should be king, could ever become the greatest king. But that's what happens. Okay? The gospel is not about us and our power and effort seeking to become something. It's God taking us from literally nothing and raising us and conforming us to his image. So I want us to make sure we see that. Because David becomes a figure or a picture of the Messiah, of this king who reigns victoriously, defeating enemies and establishes peace. All right. So Luke, in closing prayer.